My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to another of my series of nostalgia interviews recorded before the lockdown of 2020. And my guest this week is Alex Davis, who is doing an MA in ancient history at the University of Kent. Alex talks about growing up in the village of Lydd, going to university as a mature student after working in the accounts department in her family's business. She studied classics and ancient history. We learn where the passion for her subject came from and how she would have done something geosciences-based if she'd gone straight to university from school. We talk about the value of doing a degree, the critical skills that we acquire, why deadlines come naturally to Alex. We talk about her earliest memories, the music that she used to listen to in the family car, for example, from Queen while she was growing up, and the way that music from, say, school discos can pull us right back. We learn that Alex is more of a book person than a music person, and that she and her partner are currently rereading the work of Terry Pratchett. Alex talks about the influence of her school geography teacher, how her parents used to be involved in the Conservative Party. We learn what it was like to meet Michael Howard, who used to be her MP in the flesh. We discuss the value of clubs and societies. She talks about going to church when she was younger. We discuss how if something in life is easy, then there really isn't that much fun in doing it. Alex reveals that giving up is not in her nature and how she once hated having to pull out of running a race. Then in the final part of the interview, Alex talks about what it was like to grow up in a small town, about how we learn from things that happened in the past, and why Alex refuses my two options of whether she is a looking forward or a looking back kind of person. So join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews pre-2020 lockdown. My guest this week is Alex Davis. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have Alex Davis here, and not the first podcast you've done in SECL, of course, Alex.
It isn't. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. I contributed with a couple of classmates to David Walsh's podcast a few weeks ago.
And I heard that, and that was brilliant. And also, David was my first guest. So there was a period then I did David, and then I think until I did Patty Baker, there were no other classics colleagues on my podcast, so then suddenly I sort of made up for it a bit in recent months. So it's lovely to have you on board.
And
you're doing?
I'm an MA, ancient history student, part time. So I'm going to take 2 years to do that. And I graduated with my undergraduate degree from the department last summer now.
And a phenomenally good degree, I think. Although you may be too modest to say that, but I think I met you at graduation. I'm pretty sure we were having a conversation at the ceremony, or just before, during the drinks reception beforehand.
Absolutely.
Phenomenally good.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
that's you. Really. So tell me. So obviously you were at Kent before doing your present course of study. But tell me a little bit, Alex, about your background. Sort of where you're from.
I'm from Kent originally. I grew up in a little town called Lydd, which is about 45 minutes from here, and went to a local school and didn't entirely feel ready to go to university then, so I'm a mature student, but come full circle now to a degree. But I grew up in very small town, very different from Canterbury.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that near sort of between Folkestone and Hastings? Is that?
Yes, it is.
I know. I used to many years ago before I started driving. I used to get the bus. I used to get loads of work done because it was like a 3-hour journey from Hastings to Folkestone. And I'm sure Lydd was one of the places we've passed through. Is that? So
blink and you'd miss it.
So I associate that with a Sunday afternoon with a good book and or in terms of background. Mm-hmm. So when you came to university, was that something that you always expected to do, or did you have a whole sort of other life before going to university?
I went to school, I did my A-levels, but at that 17, 18 stage, I did not feel ready to leave home and go off to university, and I really didn't have much of an idea what I wanted to do. My parents at the time were running our family business, which was also based in Lydd, with my father's co-director. And my mum was looking to step back a little bit from the business. Her parents were getting more elderly and needed a bit more care. And so I moved into the business, as did my brother at a similar time, at the lowest level in the accounts department. Yeah. And slowly over the next 22 years, we both progressed up. Yeah. slowly took over more of the businesses. Yes. Our parents stepped back, and they're now retired and they live in Spain. Yeah. And so I spent 22 years finishing up as finance director.
Yeah. Wow. So then doing a degree, was it classics or ancient history?
My degree was classical and archaeological studies.
Yeah. So how did you make the leap then from accountants? The reason I ask is that it's so interesting. When I was a student, I literally, at the age of 18, went to university. And it was a wonderful experience, but there was sort of a lack of life experience in the sense that a few of my friends worked, but that was because more because they wanted to rather than they had to. How different are students now? They might have like bar work, but generally everyone was on campus. It was a campus-based university. Nobody ever left. Mm. But then I see my students now, and I'm awestruck by them in many ways because in addition to their studies full-time, they have to hold down jobs and family commitments. And it just seems that there's a different degree of pressure to what I had the luxury of, you know, not having to worry about 25 or whatever years ago. So to go from doing work at the council department to ancient history, it's a fascinating journey to me.
It's been unusual. I wasn't excited about going to university after school because I just didn't go to that great a school, and why would I want to do this for another 3 years? So I went into the business, and a few years later I did regret not having gone to university. So I took an open university degree, which is in geosciences, which is another odd leap of subject. So astronomy and geology and things like that. And I thoroughly enjoyed doing that. And I did that while, as you say, while I was working full time. So that took me 8-9 years. Yeah. That was very hard work when you're holding down a full-time job. Yeah. And during the last couple of years of doing that, I met my partner, Owen, who's a senior lecturer here in statistics. And I discovered through both of those things that actually university is completely different to studying A-levels at school. And we got to the stage in the business where my parents wanted to fully retire and step back. So we put the business up for sale. And the new owner has a finance background, so he didn't require my services anymore. So there I was one day standing in the car park, and the thing you see in American films with the box with the pot plant and the mug and the coffee, standing looking back at the building thinking, oh goodness, now what? And I'd already wondered about maybe doing a degree full time and discussed that with Owen, and that seemed like a good way to go into it. So I started investigating into that. And then I took access to higher education diploma at Canterbury College because it had been a number of years since I'd written an essay. Yeah. My geosciences degree was a lot more practical and maths-based, really, than anything. So I took an access course at Canterbury College, and that was phenomenal, brilliant preparation for university. Very, very good in terms of teaching us to write essays, teaching us to reference, teaching us to research, teaching us to write coherently and in a structured fashion,
and
here I excelled. Am
it's acting on those impulses which we all have when we're young. I mean, I've got really young children, and of course I asked one of them, what do you want to be when you're older? And it was great because he said he wants to be, wait for this now, he said he wants to be a dentist, a teacher and a fire engine. And I said I was thinking, does he mean a fireman or the fire engine? But I almost thought, I don't want to ask too much. I thought, I want it to be the fire engine because it's so wonderful that he's got this sort of clear sense of what he wants. And I just thought, and it's such disparate interests. But of course, you know, I rather doubt, you know, whether he could be one of those, I guess. He's certainly not going to be all three. But that's the thing. And it's almost as though I had dreams. Actually, I always wanted to do something sort of radio based, but never did. But went to university at 18. So in a way, sort of the opposite to yourself, in the sense that I went to university at 18, but in a way that there was no other kind of like obvious, like there was no plan B as such. And then and loved it and have stayed here all this time. But I've always had that sort of back of my mind: is there something else that I could and should have been doing? So the podcast is a great way into that sort of alternative life. But how did classics become the subject, or ancient history become the subject that you chose?
Oh, well, actually, just to touch back on something that you just said, that your little boy said he wanted to be a fire engine. Yeah. I remember my nephew, who's now very smart man, training to be a mechanic. He asked me when he was about three what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I told him I wanted to be a fire engine. There was a minute or so while he thought about it, and then he came back and said, but you can't be a fire engine. And there was lots of laughs, and it's become a joke. But classics actually came in. I'm generally fascinated by all sorts of things. We watch loads and loads of documentaries about all sorts of weird and wonderful subjects. Yeah. But I remember specifically reading a lot as a kid. I read everything voraciously. Yeah. I was a struggle to keep up with. We only had a very small library in Lydd. But my parents bought me at one point the Roger Lancelin Green retellings of the ancient Greek myths. And I read that so many times, actually I pulled it off the bookshelf the other day at home and it is falling to pieces. And I think that's where my interest really lies. I'm also very interested in ancient Egypt, which is not a subject we teach much of here. But Chava's got some fascinating sounding modules which are good for that. So I guess really just comes from a real interest in history as a whole and in literature. Did English literature at A-level.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in both of those things, and classics seems to merge those.
Yeah. But it also sounds as though you're doing now what you probably wouldn't have enjoyed doing. If suddenly at the age of 18 you found yourself doing the degree that you're doing now, it probably wouldn't have been the right thing at the right time. So it was worth waiting all those years.
Yeah, if I'd have gone after A-levels, I also did chemistry and geography at A-level, and I did a GCSE in geology during the first year of A-levels as well. So I would have done geosciences then. I subsequently did that with the OU.
Yeah.
But I really just didn't feel ready to move on. Yeah. And yeah, we were lucky enough to be given this opportunity to move into the family business, which we would never have had if we hadn't been able to do the job.
Yeah.
But to work with a family,
but life amazing. Experience,
and then you gain life experience. You understand a little bit more about what do I want to do? What fascinates me?
Yeah.
And also all the other things you learn. Yeah. Yeah. Working as well to be organised, time management, all those things.
Yeah, no, and I actually think that that's one of the most important things in the degree, because I remember once I was on a bus somewhere to Swansea when I was doing my PhD, early in the mid-90s, and the chap asked what I was doing, and I said, I'm doing a PhD. He said, oh, you're a brain box then? And I thought, no, I know I'm not. I thought, but I know what I do have, and it's those critical skills involving time management, organisation, commitment to something. Yeah. Because being, you might need to be really super clever to win Mastermind, but to do a PhD, you really need to have that commitment to read around the discipline of doing something, assimilating notes and materials. Rather, so it's not so much what you know as how you can apply what you know. And in a way, I always, I had many conversations over the years with people who sort of say, well, we're not the sort of people who would know all the answers to programs on a quiz show, but we would be able to, we would step away and say, well, let's go and find what the answers are then, or the equivalent of.
Yes.
And then and have a problem or a thesis that you want to unpack and spend 3 or 4 years of your life doing that and not giving up. Mm. And that is something which you don't necessarily know at the time. You always imagine, oh, is this formidable, journey that you're going to be on that only a few very select people will do. But when you've done it, you think, gosh, I really saw it through. And I realise that that is almost as important as, the content of what you do is unbelievably important, but also the way in which you process it and you start the journey, you end the process, go through all the rituals involved. And, at all levels, I've said, I don't just mean the PhD. And obviously, that's what you're doing. So you must feel like so amazed, so proud of what you've done in the last few years.
It's certainly been one of the best things I've ever done.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was very unsettled and very upset when my parents first announced that they think it's time that we sold the business. I sat and cried.
Yeah.
And then I got home from work and Owen said, what's the matter? And I sat and cried again.
Yeah.
But yes, having made this decision and studied something that I'm fascinated by and become more fascinated by as time goes on, I've done 3 years of Latin, I'm learning Greek, and I've developed a real passion for the subject. I'm not earth-shatteringly smart, but as you say, if I get given something, I will treat it as work. I have treated my studies as work in that 9-to-5-30 kind of approach and that commitment to things. I am proud of what I've achieved, and I'm not embarrassed to say.
No, and you just made me think of something actually quite funny on that, because I'm often here at a time in the evening when the lady who does the cleaning comes into the room and she says at times, oh, you're the only person who I ever see. And I thought, it's funny, because when I did the PhD, I suppose the degree as well, I kind of treated it as a 9-to-5 sort of job, although often it would be you know, not necessarily from 9 to 5, but the equivalent of
yes.
the hours, sometimes a little bit later. But what's funny is that then, for me, when I got the job and had this office, I thought, well, I have to come here every day because it's like, this is like, you know, where else would I be? Why would I want to be doing that? But yes. I find it really funny how sometimes, you know, somebody then doesn't follow that sort of rubric, because for me, that's the only way I could do this job. The fact that it's not required, as in nobody says you have to, I don't have to clock in at 9 in the morning, all the more incentive to do it. So it's almost the way that we set ourselves our own goals, which to somebody who hasn't done anything like this probably looks a bit odd. Like, why would you do that? Where's the money, sort of thing? You think, well, that's not the sole reason why we, if that was all we did and the only reason we did it, we'd burn ourselves out and we'd probably be really miserable people.
Yeah, I think that loving the subject really does help to commit to it. But yeah, absolutely. I found that to be the easiest way. I'm used to working much more than those hours. Yeah. I'm used to spending an hour and a half driving to work and back every day. So in actual fact, compared to this, we've now got a 4-mile commute. Mm-hmm. We come in every morning.
Yeah.
So we go back and have a cup of coffee. Yeah. We go off to our respective offices and we go home at the end of the day. And that works. And that largely means I don't usually need to work in the evenings or at the weekends. And it just makes sense to apply something I've been doing for so long anyway.
And I think that's the thing. It's when it was something that I had a cholesterol test the other day. And actually it was interesting what the nurse said to me. She said, don't change your lifestyle overnight. She said, just sort of incrementally do things or do things a bit differently, but do them in ways that can be accommodated within what you do. So in other words, if you're somebody who hasn't done any exercise, the idea that you suddenly run a mile every day, you know, suddenly you're probably, it's probably going to affect you, you know, your health more than if you just have a few brisk walks and so on. So in that sense, I suppose it's the same. Like if you already have that mindset that you know how to be organized and work, the transition to doing postgraduate study is actually going to be pretty easy because the crucial skills you already have, you don't have to learn those.
Yes,
you've already got them.
Yes we're running a business and dealing with the likes of HM Revenue and Customs. Now I look at deadlines, and well, deadlines is just natural to me. And the fact that there's no wiggle room on deadlines is natural to me. I recognize that again is a lucky position to be in, that I'm in the position I can spend some time studying. And I'm lucky that I do have those skills already. Because some of that transition from school to degree is so difficult because of that. It's not about learning a new subject or anything. It's it's that different, utterly different way of working at university too.
What about earliest memories? I mean, what do you remember from childhood?
What do I remember? I remember, so we lived in this very small town, and my mum's parents lived just around the corner. So I remember seeing them a lot. I always remember my grandfather had a long tweed coat and a tweed flat cap. And we had the house had a very long driveway, and you could be out in the garden playing, and you'd turn and you'd look up and you'd see Grandad just walking down the driveway. And that's kind of, that's how I remember him. And Nan and Grandad would pop round, and my father's parents lived in St Mary's Bay, so not that far away as well. And my great aunt and her mother, so my great grandmother, lived in Folkestone. So most of those next generations up of a family all lived really close. So I remember spending a lot of time with them as kids, but also spending quite a lot of time in the business as well. You know, we had part-time jobs if we needed them, we would spend time helping out, particularly if we were very busy. We were a smaller company then. So again, I also grew up with the people that we employed, some of whom we still employed by the time we sold the business. So they very much also became a bit of an extended family in a way. There was always somebody else you could go to. My dad's co-director in particular, Richard, was unfortunately, we lost him a few years ago, but he was fundamentally part of the family as well. So some of my earliest memories are seeing all those people a lot.
But it's funny, isn't it, how there's always that the concept of composite memories, because like when somebody like a wave or a gesture that you remember, you're probably remembering 1,000 of them, but you sort of distill them into one essence, or you're picking one and maybe associate it with a particular day or a particular event. And it may not, that wave or whatever, it might not happen on that day, but it'd be easy to imagine that. And you sort of put, you know, it was almost like the crystallization
yes.
of all these different events and memories and people. And it's only sometimes, because I've always kept a diary, but so sometimes you think, well, that may not, that memory, it probably isn't entirely accurate
yes.
because at least I can't find the fit for it. I can't find, you know, when that might have happened. But you associate things in context. And that actually leads on to the next question, which was about like music, because for me, you know, I suppose it's different sort of memory, I suppose, but it's sort of like remembering what I used to listen to in the charts or the music from when I was growing up, and remembering the different stages, what I was doing at school, what my homework was that evening, or what, you know, all the conversations I'd have in the playground with friends. And so even now to this day, listening to stuff from 35, 40 years ago, and I am transported back to those conversations and those experiences. But do you have anything similar, for example, involving music that you can relate to?
I think we the place we always heard a lot of music was in the car as kids. My as a family, we had a several caravans over a period of time, and we had an big American motorhome, and we would spend a lot of time holidaying in France and Netherlands, Germany, Spain, which is where my parents first really felt at home in Spain, and that's why they now live there. So we drove thousands and thousands of miles. My dad would he would get in the car at Calais and he would drive, and he could quite cheerfully get to Barcelona, and still can in one hit. And we would ride on holiday, but we would listen to music in the car while we went, and some of it you hated and some of it you really liked, and every now and then you could convince dad to put on one of the tapes, of course, one of the tapes that we liked. I think that's one of those places I can see the four of us sitting in the car. My dad's driving and the caravan's on the back, and you can feel the slightly different movement of the car because the van's on
absolutely.
The back. We used to listen to loads of stuff. Dad would make sure that everything was all there, and he'd select all the things and put them all in a case and make sure we were all so just to keep us entertained, really.
And what sort of music do you particularly remember?
A massive variety. We listened to a lot of Queen, which as a kid I didn't like. Horrified to admit that now, because they are the living end. But a massive variety, some classical things. My dad had a CD of Cajun music, which I loathed and still do. And a lot of rock music, pop music. Really remember most 80s music and the original, now that's what I call music. Tapes. We had the original one, and we'd buy them each time they came out. So we used to listen to those a lot in the car. So 80s pop really transports me back in a way that I don't really engage with a lot of pop music now.
Well, it's the same with me, because I don't know if you listen to a lot of the nostalgia radio show, you know, the sounds of the 80s type programs, what I think works about those programs is that they're live, and they're people talking about what's happening now in 2020, so they're very much of the present moment, but they're, so it's about the music that people were listening to 35 40 years ago, and that's the crucial bit, because it's how the music has stood the test of time, including some of the novelty records from the time that, you know, we all love to hate. But it's interesting that it's the context of the music. It's not just the music in themselves, it's the way that they have being almost like markers for people in their relationships. And, you know, the day that, you know, somebody might say, oh, that was in the charts on the day I passed my driving test or something like that. And so therefore it's sort of carried with them. And it's also quality proof, because it's not about whether the music's any good or not. It's the fact that it's related to a particular period. Doesn't matter. I mean, you know, even if it's, I don't know, Winifred School Choir, number one, Christmas 1980, you know, at the end of the day, it's so relevant to a particular stage in life that you associate it with that. And if you take the music away and say, I'm not listening to that, or it's terrible music, you also almost distorting all the other memories of what was happening around that, that you actually think, well, no, I kind of want to preserve that, because that was, you know, symbolic of my growing up at a particular period in, say, primary school.
Yes, these music is, in the way that smell is evocative, is really evocative of a time. And you, again, as you said earlier, you remember where you heard that song.
Yeah.
I remember going to school discos where I heard You hear a song, and if you hear it now, it pulls me back to that.
The Queen thing is interesting because it's funny how at the time it wasn't amazing, but then became so. Could that have been like peer pressure? Because I used to find at school, I used to like music that other people sometimes would sneer at. You know, the first record I ever bought was Buck's Fizz, Making Your Mind Up. And it was like, oh, that's not very cool. Of course, these days, I think because, you know, people, Eurovision is so kitsch and so, really, I think people think, wow, you know. But at the time, a lot of my friends at school or you know, were always into sort of more sort of heavy metal type music, not my thing. And because I wasn't part of their demographic, therefore, when their music would come on, it would be very much sort of, you know, Simple Minds, when I've also been huge in the 80s, and it was sort of their thing, not mine, and I wasn't part of that community. But as the years went on, so I thought, this is really good stuff, because I can enjoy it on my own terms. But Queen, because they're so phenomenal, it was there like a point when you suddenly thought, oh, this is actually rather good?
I think that's one of those things that you come to, you grow up, and when you're eight, you maybe don't appreciate these things. And afterwards, you suddenly thought, no, actually, I really like this stuff. This is amazing. I prefer the earlier work to the later stuff. But they are phenomenal, and I've made friends at school because they had this love of that as well. If I'm honest, music doesn't bother me that much, which I think people quite often think is a bit odd. I don't mind if there's music or if there's not. I like it. It doesn't matter to me. My partner Owen is very, very interested in music, buys a lot of CDs, downloads a lot of music, listens to a lot of things. But if given the choice between music and a book, I would soon have a book.
And what about reading then in that sense? Because you mentioned that you used to read everything voraciously.
I still do. I don't get so much time to read things that don't have to do with the Emperor Augustus these days. And I'm doing a module in Greek philosophy at the moment, so there's a lot of reading involved in that. But, I still read a lot, as much as I can. Mostly we read in the evenings when we've finally, we've stopped for the day and we can spend some time doing that. But Owen and I's interests gel very well in reading. We're big Terry Pratchett fans, fantasy and sci-fi fans.
And do you read separately or together? Because if you both do, is it like a shared communal exercise, or do you like read a book and then recommend it and then
both
pass
really.
It on?
Yeah. And we're currently rereading all the Terry Pratchetts because sadly he's not writing anymore, bless him. And some of those books, it's 20 years since one of us read it last, he suggested it. So right. There's the first one. Let's make a start. So he reads them and then passes them over, and we've got a stack, and we keep working down. And when we first moved in together, we had so many books together that the house had it was only a very small dining room in it, and we had bookshelves put in, much like the bookshelves that I'm looking at in your office right now. And we put all the books on the shelves. So this is a small room in the house with bookshelves around three sides, with lovely wooden shelves. And we had an awful lot of books that were the same. We had a big stack of books that we passed to my parents, because actually we've both got a copy of those. So it's something that we're both very interested in. I will read electronic books, but there's no substitute for it.
I also have in my office lots of videos. Now, I would never watch these now, because obviously technology's moved on. And I, you know, now that we have things in wonderful HD, the idea of watching something in an old analog 4x3, you know, format really doesn't appeal. However, like with the books you mentioned, there's something about having bought, probably each one of those, I can tell you today, you know, but I used to live in a part of Wales where we didn't have any major high street stores, or there was no cinema. So I'd make a pilgrimage, really, I guess, to Swansea or somewhere, and might see a film. But if there was something I really wanted to get, you know, I'd wait very patiently until the Saturday. Didn't have online, you know, in the early 90s, didn't have online things. Yeah, didn't have Amazon. So I would make that very particular journey. And therefore I can't get rid of them. But at the same time, I have no problem reading books electronically, perhaps in a way that I know that they're not going to get scuffed, they're not going to get damaged. Mm. And if I lost the Kindle, then there would be, you know, I could always watch the same, read the same book yes. on another format. I still got it on another device or the computer, but it's stored. But it is interesting, but I do things differently. Most people are happy to stream videos and watch things in a very sort of, in a digital format, whereas I tend to like watching them on Blu-ray or actually, you know, or going to the cinema and actually having, you know, very sort of concrete, watch it in the now sort of thing. But when it comes to books, I'm less particular, but it seems like the inverse of what most people's experiences are.
Yeah, I do prefer a book in a physical format, which doesn't always do my back any good carrying half the contents of the library around all the time. Yeah. But I think that's good. And certainly if you're going to be working with a textbook, it has to be a physical thing because any post-it notes and highlights.
Yeah. I was going to ask actually, do you annotate the books that you read for both the pleasure and academically?
I don't annotate books I read for pleasure, but academically, yes, I do. It took me a little while to get used to writing in a book. Mm. There's still a little thing in the back of my head that says it's deeply wrong. I find it intensely annoying if I get a book out of the library and somebody's written in something, because but once it's mine, I write on it, I some post-it notes in it, I highlight things, make notes, and can usually, my first year Latin textbook, I can tell you what page some of the things are, the subjects are on. So they're a tool to be used. They're the tool of what we do.
And again, it also made me think that back when you were reading voraciously as a young person, the skills that you then have applied to your degree, for example, also no doubt your job as well, in terms of having that sort of degree of everything being very sort of well in your mind catalogued and classified and remembering page numbers, whatever it might be. But at the time, you never quite imagine the use that something that you often perhaps see as recreation or entertainment or pleasure or something can actually be instrumental in terms of defining who you are. And that's the unexpected bit, because I was only just thinking, you know, I wouldn't want my epitaph to be, because obviously technically my job title is my first degree was in theology, and indeed I am a theologian in that, you know, in terms of my subject area. But it also feels that would be a very narrow, constricted way of categorising who I am. And it's funny how sometimes we get associated with our particular professional lives, or people know us for maybe, or in my case, the books I might write. But in other respects, people know me in a very different sort of way, or through a very different sort of apparatus or different sets of media. So it's funny the way in which sometimes the things that define us are often the things that on a CV you wouldn't ever think to put down, but they're the things that people associate with you, if people who grew up with you in school or university and beyond.
Yes, and I think particularly because we focus on what do you do? Yeah. That's the first question we ask. We frequently holiday in America, and more often than not, their initial question is, where are you from?
Yeah.
Fundamental question of that's the really important thing. But yes, we think about who are you? What do you do? Well, I'm a student.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not all I am. Yeah. Yes, we've got so many different hats, so many different roles that we have.
Yeah.
I don't really feel as though I'm a student really covers it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. and but in that sense, what about things like teachers that inspired you? Because I find that sometimes even when I'm lecturing, I'm sort of implicitly, or maybe because I'm thinking more of it, not least through all the nostalgia work I'm doing, but thinking, where do I get these mannerisms from, or who or what am I channeling? And sometimes it's the teachers who inspire me. It might actually be just the different modes of presenting or broadcasters. I sort of think almost like giving a lecture in the way that, you know, a great newsreader or DJ or something, or a lot of people who I've interviewed have spoken about stand-up comics who've influenced them, and that when they're lecturing, they sort of feel that they're doing that sort of thing, that sort of approach to their work. But in your case, were there particular teachers who inspired you at university or at school who made you think, yes, that's what I want to be, or I want to sort of like follow that? You mentioned already with Egyptology, for example, but do you sort of feel that there are those particular go-to people?
Certainly when we were at secondary school, we had a geography teacher who, as I said, I did GCSE geology with him in the first year of our A-levels, and he came to my friend and I and said, I'm thinking about running this course, would you take it? And the fact that he took the time to seek us out and ask us that question made an impact on me, because, well, yes, actually, I would have loved to have done it, even if it had just been on a list. But he took the time to bother to ask us. And we had an English teacher during our A-levels, and she would recommend me books and say, oh, you should read this. Just the fact, again, that she took the time to do that. So they were fantastic teachers, but it's that interaction that you get outside of where actually she cared enough to think, Alex would like to read that.
Yeah.
Next time I see Alex, I'll recommend it.
Yeah.
Those things, I think, make a tremendous difference.
And you're right, because the number of times a student will come up to you and say something like, oh, it was because you recommended something. It might be something I've forgotten that I even said, but it might be something to say, or it might be just a conversation and they say, I had a dissertation student recently who wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do, or he was going down a few sort of, you know, blind alleys, really. And I thought, well, based on what you've said, and I just almost like randomly mentioned something that I thought might be profitable. Mm. And he went away and he came back a few weeks later and he said, oh, my word, you know, I'm going to spend the rest of my life looking at this, a particular philosopher of religion who I referred to. And suddenly everything clicked into place, and he's just like so completely locked into, you know, his particular course of study. So it's when things like that happen, but often it takes someone just to sort of give you a little bit of a steer, a little bit of a push, and almost make you feel valued and to feel that you actually have a contribution to make, and it's worth going that extra mile. And I think I had that, you know, sometimes that need, you almost want to go back and say thank you. And in some cases, it might be odd, because, you know, 30 years on, and, you know, goodness knows, they may not even still be around. But there is that need almost to say, without sort of almost boasting, because there is that almost sense of saying, look what I've achieved. But actually, it's almost saying, but look what I've achieved, thanks to you, or at least in part due to you. Yeah.
Yes, thanks to you and to your idea. And I've had no end of those experiences since I've been at Kent. It would be unfair to pick out some and then leave out other members of the staff who've done it. But I've had that experience so many times here. People take that opportunity to say, actually, you should read this, or this would be really good, you should do this module, this would be great.
Yeah.
Those things make a difference just as much as they did when I was a kid.
Yeah. And what about things like elections or voting or anything? Because I remember the first time I voted, it was the 92 election. And it felt it was a very strange time, because I'd only ever grown up with a Conservative government, and then suddenly having that, you know, going to a polling station, putting the X, you'd think that would have gone digital. Actually, that's the one strange thing, that we still have, you know, paper voting, and it feels the world's gone digital, and yet we have to physically. Because I was in Belgium during this most recent election, I voted by post. Yeah. But things like that. I mean, the way that we identify ourselves with particular occasions, and the way and the commitments that we have, and the way we apply those. For example, it doesn't have to be in politics, but do you have any of those sort of experiences as well, of almost coming of an age and thinking, right, I can finally make a small difference maybe to a particular cause?
I think certainly from a political point of view, when I was a teenager, my parents were involved in the local Conservative Association, and got to know a few people there, and I was actually, for my sins, a young Conservative for many years. I'm not particularly political, but I like getting involved in the logistics of things, like getting involved in helping organise things and in making a difference. And our MP at the time in the Folkestone Hythe constituency was Michael Howard, who was a lovely man face to face. He didn't always come across very well on the television, unfortunately, but really lovely man face to face. And we got involved and we had some good experiences. Yeah. I made some lovely friends. We spent some time at the House of Commons. It was lots of fun. So I remember doing those things and going to a count one evening and just that feeling of, again, belonging and making a difference. I have moved on from being a Conservative now. So I think that was important. And I also think I remember very specifically, separate from that, first time I went to blood donors.
Yeah.
It's a bit random, but Mum and I went to blood donors and I gave blood and I fainted, so that was great. It's still something I do and I enjoy doing it. Again, it's a little thing, but you make a difference.
But it does make a difference, because it's something, you know, anything that we ever do that's outside of our comfort zone, but when you feel in doing it, you feel, gosh, you know, I feel so much better for doing that. And it can be, I guess something that maybe a family member has done or a friend has, or you just know it's a good cause, but something, I mean, that's what was big about Live Aid, for example, in the 80s, that suddenly you think, you know, overwhelming world poverty, what can I do to make a difference? But you feel that the opportunity was given to do that, if you so wished, by, you know, donating to the cause. But suddenly it was like, well, if you want to do something, you can do it tomorrow. And this is where you go and what you do. It somehow felt that it was possible to make a difference rather than just feel that it was, you know, in the lap of the gods. And I think, and that's why, I mean, voting is interesting because, and you mentioned Michael Howard, because I'm now in the Folkestone and Hythe constituency, but I'm right on the border. And during the election in December, it was very funny because if I'd been on the other side of the fence where I live, I'd be in the Canterbury constituency, which is marginal,
yes.
Not as marginal as it was before the election, but in the Canterbury, in the Folkestone Hythe constituency, which I knew was not really going to change hands. But it's really funny how we all get very excited or we all get sort of caught up in the minutiae sometimes of how we're going to vote and who we should vote for. And it says something about our identity, and in a way that I think is the crucial bit, that sometimes we might be happy changing political allegiance, or in some cases you almost feel you want to cling on, maybe for nostalgia purposes, or maybe a commitment to a family member that you sort of, you don't want to betray a certain sort of like, you know, they how would they feel if, you know, my parents voted differently in this election to how they'd voted in their lives, and yet in many respects the whole of my life I perhaps was influenced by them in terms of how I voted. So suddenly to find that they voted in a way that was different to how I voted, and yet it was because of them that I voted in the way that I do, it was like, come again, you know, how did that happen?
Did we change?
Yeah, yes. but that's the crucial thing. But you also realise that you have your own reasons and commitments for doing it, which is independent of maybe what your parents did. And it sounds like in your case, you as everyone does in their own way, you came to your own sense of what was the right thing to do.
Yes, absolutely. But yes, you start, you learn as we do so much from how our parents deal with things and what they teach us. But my parents don't I believe share that allegiance anymore either. And obviously they're in a slightly odd situation because they're in Spain. They should receive postal votes and they don't always, which is not a good thing that they don't get sent them. You make those decisions as you grow up. But I really got involved in it because actually it was quite fun. It was the social side of things rather than a political thing.
I mean, one of the things I really regret is not being involved in anything social as a child, in the sense that I didn't do Cubs or Scouts or even, I mean, sport was never my thing, and I did lots of, you know, learning the piano was, you know, may have seemed excited. So at the age of five, I thought, because my sister, who was a bit older than me, was learning the piano, and of course I wanted to do the same thing. But my heart was never in it. But I do look back and think that it would have been good if I'd been involved more in a community of like-minded people.
Yeah.
And I think in later years, I've sort of found that. But perhaps I started a bit late, and I look back and think that maybe I would have found my niche and things would have been more, would have been easier because you would have been around people who could make that happen rather than having this like dream of being on the radio or something. It's like, well, you know, that you can't just wake up in the morning and go on the radio. But I suppose looking back, if I'd been more involved in more clubs or societies, well, that might have led to, for example, in a hospital radio opportunity or something like that. Just funny looking back how we sometimes don't make those leaps, but they never leave us. Sometimes those ambitions, those dreams that you have from childhood sometimes stay with you decades after sometimes. And you either just say, oh well, it's too late, or you think it's never too late. And it sounds like you've already acted on those in terms of the degree that you did, because suddenly it was like, this is really something I can do. And you wouldn't have necessarily anticipated doing something like that.
No, I was fairly convinced that I would stay doing that job in the business until I retired. I'd never really, if indeed I'd ever really thought about it, that's what we did. And we had 28 staff, we're a big company, and those staff were relied on us to make sensible decisions and to make the business a success. We had amazing staff, and that was where we were. But all of a sudden to have the opportunity to say, okay, well, now what? You can go and do anything you like, was quite was quite odd. And our parents had always encouraged us. Yeah, I was a brownie. I was a girl guide. Mm. I was a ranger, I think it was called, the next level up. And thoroughly enjoyed those experiences. Mm. Growing up in a very small town, there wasn't that much to do. You had to go to Ashford or Folkestone for even a one-screen cinema in that, at that stage. Yeah. So you took advantage of all these things, and we were always encouraged to get involved in those things. I remember saying I didn't want to go to church with the brownies because it was always cold in the church, and we had to go to Remembrance Day services, and I didn't want to go because it was boring, it was cold. And I was 12. And Mum said, if you're going to be in it and go to the trip to the zoo, go on camp, go to all the fun stuff, you're going to be in it with all of it.
Yeah.
So you're either going to be in it or you're not going to be in it. It was prettier than that when she said it, but that was the thrust of it. You're going to be in or you're going to be out. And I think that kind of attitude has stuck with me. And I did go to church and I carried the flag and that was good. But I think that kind of attitude of you're either going to make a proper job of what you're doing or you're not going to do something. Really, I identify with that. And I've brought that to what I do now. I've always, you're going to commit to something or you're not.
I think that because, I mean, I do lots of cinema trips and so on, but I always see sort of everything that I don't only, in a way, it's if you're committed to something, you then have to take the good with the bad and also be surprised that you might think, this doesn't sound like my sort of thing, but I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
And you might think, that is the best thing I've ever seen. Because if you just see the things that you think you want to see.
Yeah.
You know, I've got some friends who say they only watch Disney films, but there's a point when they think, sometimes I need to watch something that's so non-Disney, like just almost to reinforce my sense of how great Disney is or whatever. but that's what I mean, that sometimes you just need to take the good and the bad and just and then sometimes come away and think, do you know what? That was arduous, but I've done it. I've sat through a 3-hour war film that I never, or whatever it might be, that I never thought I'd want to do. But you're right, in academic study as well. Sometimes you might be good at essays, but not good at presentations or exams, but you still have to do them, or at least you should do them, or at least, you know, and when you do it, sometimes you probably think, well, I was uncomfortable doing that, but I've now presented myself, don't have to do it again. I volunteered to do it. I did it. I saw it through. And you can be really proud of yourself. Whereas if you just say, I'll just do the things I want to do, then you kind of just have this really sort of very sort of niche area where you feel you're not really stretching yourself to your fullest potential.
There's no doubt whatsoever that despite the fact I've thoroughly enjoyed being a student, it has been hard. It was hard when I was studying for my Open University degree, and it was hard when I was studying my A-levels. Yeah. There's always been tears as well as everything else. Yeah. But to be honest with you, if it's easy, there's no fun in it as far as I'm concerned, because if you can just knock out an essay in a couple of hours and submit it and move on, there's no fun. The thing for me is okay, right, I'm going to make a really good job of that, and I'm going to throw as much as I possibly can at it, despite the fact I will probably cry twice while I've done it. When I get the grade back and the comments and the lecturers are saying, this is a really good piece of work, very impressed with this, this is a good point, great.
Yeah.
I take a great deal of pleasure in that, which sometimes I'm sure makes me extremely annoying to my classmates. I take great pleasure in doing something properly.
But no, what you're saying is right, because having a balance or equilibrium in something that we do doesn't just mean doing the things and only doing the things that we like. It can also mean the effort involved in seeing something through and doing extreme things, but then in having done that, you kind of feel that you've achieved something and you can then move on to the next stage, whatever it might be. But so balance isn't just about, you know, sort of being constantly happy all the time. It can also be, there's the tears, but when you shed the tears, you think, wow, I didn't know I could do that, right? What's the next challenge, sort of thing? And that gives you the incentive to carry on. The worst thing you could do is then think, well, I've done everything, nothing to get up for, you know? And that's when you really will start to suffer.
And giving up is really not in my mentality. Yeah. I took up running a number of years ago, and I've run 5 marathons, run a lot of half marathons, things like that. And again, as with probably most essays I write, every time I run a marathon I have cried at least once, but looking back on those experiences, I'm really, really glad that I did them. I'm not quick, not by any stretch, but they've been positive experiences, and Owen laughs when I say running is purely mental. I mean, yeah, it is completely mental. But it's about what goes on in your head. Can you force yourself to do that? Can you commit to doing it? Or can you stop? If you just stop and give up, that's really easy to give up. But the worst race I ever ran was a 10-mile race I was forced to pull out halfway through because of an injury.
And
I was forced to pull out. And I still look back on that as my worst race ever because I had to pull out. And I hate I pulled out. So yeah, it's something I guess that tracks through everything I do.
No,
I will do things properly. I will make a proper job of it.
Yeah, and it perhaps links with what we were saying earlier about how sometimes just because you don't have to be doing a job, you know, nobody's actually saying at 9 o'clock in the morning, come on, why aren't you starting? But if you treat it as a 9-to-5 job for yourself, then that's far more rewarding. Because if somebody said to you, right, you have to clock on, and you have to, if you're not starting at 9 o'clock tomorrow, then you'll be in trouble, then you'd say, hang on a minute, you know, and then suddenly you would take all the pleasure. That part of the goal is being self-motivated, not waiting for someone to tell you what to do. I mean, I've had PhD students, some of them have been, you know, they've all been amazing in their own ways, but sometimes some of them need a real push.
Sure.
Some of them need, you know, to be, you know, day to day, well, you know, if you don't tell them what to do, they won't do it. And others, you feel you don't need me, you know, because they just go off and do it. So, you know, so it's all finding the right sort of, well, balance, back to that word. But you mentioned the church and LID. Did that play a big role growing up in a small town, I guess, a nearby church? Has that sort of impacted on you? Because I'm asking that as a theologian, but interested in the role of the church.
Sure. Yeah. We didn't have a religious upbringing in any way, shape or form. The going to church was the formal occasions where groups within the town were required to go, so Remembrance Sunday being one of them, to represent the group that we're with, and that's very important. My grandmother or my grandparents certainly went to church more in the religious line, but it wasn't something that we were brought up with. But growing up in a small town certainly is a very different experience, because you were fully aware that if you were out playing with your friends and you misbehaved, somebody would see you. And you knew full well all those people knew who you were.
Yeah.
You were Alex from DED and you were Edie's granddaughter. Some, it would get back.
Yeah.
So not that we were badly behaved children, but you knew that you were in that small community. And you also knew that if you did have a problem, actually, there would be somewhere to go. There would be somebody who knew Nan, and you knew a lot of people, and still now it's very rare I go back to the town now. I went through there, drove through there on my way to Rye the other day, which was a very strange experience, just coming over the bridge into the town, and I drove through it almost without thinking about it, because I'd done it day in, day out for so many years. But I drove it, and it was all so familiar, and just how many memories I've had from effectively living and working there for so long. But yeah, a small town's a really different environment to live in. And Canterbury sometimes can be a lot like that. It is a quite a small community.
Yeah, because when you're young, it's not a case of small town, big town. It's the only you know, you only know home. The environment you're in. It's what's home.
Yes.
But often it's going to university when suddenly you are aware then that, not least in terms of the people you're with and the different places they've come from and their different experiences, that you start to sort of see this through. Because I'm from Cardiff, admittedly the suburbs, but I would hardly call myself, in when I was young, a city person. I never went on my own. I didn't do the cinema or anything like that. I do now. So people would always say to me, God, you're so lucky living in Cardiff because you've got the castle, and they'd go through all the different things, and I'd think, I never do any of those things. So it's like, oh, and they'd look at me like, but you live in this amazing place, but you've never taken advantage of it. And I thought, how interesting. Yeah.
Yes, it is true. We don't go on holiday to the places we live locally to. And certainly when Owen and I first lived in Canterbury, we made a point of visiting the Beany, visiting the cathedral, visiting the Roman Museum, obviously. I think it's important to engage with what's on your doorstep, because you miss out on so much. It's very easy to get on a plane and fly off to New York and experience that. But what about all these astonishing places?
Oh, I have found in the last few years, I've really got to know the seaside around Kent in a way that now that I drive, I could do those things before, but I didn't really to the same degree. And realising just how much from Whitstable and Herne Bay down to Dover, Folkestone, and obviously Thanet, and just sort of thinking, God, the opportunity for walks. And often a lot of these small towns have a cinema. So of course that's often the part of it. So it's like, so it's exactly, so it's you know, so there's an incentive in there as well. So you can have a brisk walk, maybe fish and chips or something like that, and see a film. But you kind of feel that that you can make a complete day of it rather than just feel it as like a random sort of exercise. You can develop structures around it. And so I quite agree. I'd been in Canterbury for probably about 15 years before I really, certainly 10 years before I started to really appreciate the whole area.
We took a train to Rochester the other day and walked around the cathedral and around the castle and looked in the museum, had lunch, and it was a very, very nice day. Yeah. And I realised standing there, I don't think I've ever been here before.
Yeah, exactly.
And Rochester is it's a lot further from Lydd, but it's no real distance. No. But yeah, living in a small town, there wasn't that kind of thing. There was really nothing there. So you did have to go further to engage with this stuff. You had to go into Ashford or Folkestone originally to go to the cinema, and it was a two-screen cinema, I think. Yeah. So it's nice to have those opportunities on our doorstep.
And just some more philosophically based questions as we start to wrap up. I was, you know, this thing about memories. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive as you survey your whole life?
Yes, absolutely. We've had a varied life. I thoroughly enjoyed the job I did overall. Of course, like everybody's jobs, I had days where I loathed it. But it was an amazing experience to be able to learn to do that job. And generally, we looked after. We've seen lots of seen lots of the world. Got involved in.
But I think that's the thing, is related to what we were just saying earlier about being like nostalgic about negative experiences. Yeah. Maybe that's an interesting way of putting it. But like you were saying, you were driving back through Lydd the other day, or in some cases, being reminded of things like the running or whatever, where you sometimes think, oh, maybe something didn't quite work out in a way. But it's what you learned from doing that, the skill. Yes. You had to pull out of a race due to an injury, but that probably gave you a real spur to say, right, that can't happen again. So in a funny way, a negative experience can become something. But for me, nostalgia is not just about remembering the past, good or bad, but it's about how you did things then, good and bad, how you engage with them. So you've almost got the apparatus in place for saying, if something like this happens again, you kind of know how you're going to see it through.
Yes.
And that, I think, is something which is often far more important than the actual nuts and bolts of what you did. It's your response to events as a teenager, say, and then what you do 20, 30 years later as you find yourself in the same or similar situations again.
Yeah, it's easy to think it sounds a bit cliche, but everything that happens to you learn from it.
Yeah.
You learn from these things, and that makes you a more rounded individual, I guess, and a better person, and you benefit from that. There obviously are experiences that nobody would ever want to have. I'm lucky enough that I don't really feel as though I've had those kind of experiences. I've had a positive world, and I've been very lucky.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for the fact that I've been very lucky.
Yeah.
But I love what I do now, but I don't think I would be here if it wasn't for what I've done before.
Yeah.
I am a better student now than I would ever have been if I'd gone to university at 18.
Absolutely. And do you think that, say, your 5 or your 15-year-old self would be really surprised to see what you're doing now?
Yes, I think so. Maybe not subject matter surprised, but surprised that I've not got a jolly serious job and that's not what I'm doing. I work in an outreach department at the university. I love that job and it is extremely serious, but I don't have that 9 to 5:30 approach and that 9 to 5:30 life that maybe when you're 10 or 15 is something that the school certainly holds up as that goal. I've done it, spent years doing it, but actually it's much more fun doing other stuff.
Yeah.
Not that I would trade those 20 odd years for anything.
Yeah. And it sounds like you are in touch with friends from your past.
Yes, absolutely. I'm still in touch with a few people that work for us. My best friend there, she moved to the Isle of Wight. So that was a bit of a shame that she's so far away. And some friends that I was at school with. And yeah, you don't hang on to many people, do you? Once you leave school, you all stand outside the A-level results room saying, oh, let's keep in touch. And unfortunately, you don't.
Well, so are you on social media at all in that sense?
To a very limited extent. It's something that I do university-wide for societies and things like that. It's not something that... I'm not into photographing my breakfast and getting excited about it.
No, because I always find that really interesting about how when you're at school or university, of course you plan to keep in touch with everybody. And in a strange way, in the last few years, I have reconnected with those people because I wasn't on social media for years. And then I suddenly sort of, took it on completely, but only when I was ready for it. That's the crucial bit.
I sometimes
get people randomly contacting me and I was like, I wasn't ready for that. I was like, I at this stage in my life, I don't think I can suddenly go into this. But then I found when I was ready for it, I know I won't look back in the sense that, once I take something on, keep a diary from the age of 9, you never stop doing it. But I wasn't ready for it until a few years ago. And I think also because some people you put on pedestals, sometimes people you haven't seen in 30 years, there's the fear factor as well as what happens when your expectations, because also if they meet your expectations, then your life can't carry on as it is because these people are suddenly, somehow have to be integrated back into your life. But they have their own lives and you have your own life. But also there's the whole thing of what happens when you find that those people that you've for years maybe been imagining as these, awesome people, perhaps sort of say, who are you? You have to be very careful how you navigate your way through the past.
Yes, it's an awkward thing to go back because, you have an idealised view of how a specific relationship, friendship, whatever it was, and then if you suddenly start trawling back into it, I think that can be very uncomfortable. So now I've largely avoided getting involved in that as much as possible. I don't think it's a particularly healthy environment apart from anything else. I think it could be easily be a time drain as well. And it is, but it's wonderful to look back and experience those. The thing I really think is the most important way that I like to do that is the physical photographs. And I've got hundreds of photographs at home that my grandparents took and that we've taken as a family and that indeed I've taken. And those little literally snapshots are the thing I like to look back at, putting them in. Yeah. I'm still working on it, but putting them into albums and looking back at what we did and oh goodness, what was her name? I just think it's a nice way to look back on what happened without running the risk that particular friend you were friends with at school's not the person that you remember them.
Absolutely, yeah. And my very last question, Alex, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I guess looking forward because I have an eye on where I'm going next. But I think more than anything, I'm enjoying where I am now. So I guess actually I'm going to refuse either of your options and I'm going to say now. What's going on now? Yeah. What's important to me now? Where are we? Yeah. Am I enjoying this? Yeah. What am I going to do after this master's is finished? Yeah. That's slightly unanswered question, although I am heading in the direction of a PhD, but just enjoying the work and where we are.
That was a brilliant answer because it was only after I did a few of them that I realised that some people were not going to play ball. Some people would say looking back or forward, and some would say present.
Yes.
And one person in particular said, what a ridiculous question. And we spent the next 20 minutes unpacking the question.
Yes.
But the reason I've always kept that in is because, of course, it opens up so many different, there are so many different ways of answering that. And it kind of also sort of says where you are at a particular moment. So, but thank you so much, Alex. That's been
You're
a really
welcome.
Wonderful interview. I really enjoyed meeting you this morning.
Appreciate the chance. Thank you.